the more involved your own father was, the more you see equal partnership in relationships and in parenting as important. You believe that men and women have equal value in political spheres and at work. And they're less emotionally stoic. So they're more likely, they're less socially isolated. They're more likely to talk about their emotions. They're more likely to provide emotional support to other people.
This week on the Here Together podcast, in belated recognition of Father's Day, we are releasing in full another of the episodes of the Remaking Manhood podcast, which I co-host and co-produce with Mark Green. In this episode, we interview Kevin Schaefer, an associate professor of sociology at Brigham Young University, and he's conducting ongoing research around the surprising impact of engaged fathers and how that engagement later shows up in the adult lives of their sons. Hint. It's really good news for gender equity. Hello, hotties. Welcome to the weekly podcast for people craving a sense of connectedness, a dose of empathy, a glimpse of the way forward, and an opportunity to engage. In this episode, Kevin Schaefer explains his research and connects it to both his own fathering and fatherhood. Despite how complex the parent-child relationship is, Kevin is able to provide some really basic and actionable tips for how to raise kids who can grow up authentically and resist the boxes that domination culture wants to shove them into. At the end of this episode, Mark and I tell some stories about our own connections to our dads and what kind of protective factors their engaged parenting gave us. I hope you get a lot out of this conversation. We'd love to hear from you about your understanding of fatherhood and engaged fatherhood. Who helped you become who you are? What hopes do you have for fathers and children today? What can we do as a culture and a nation to support more engaged parenting? Okay, let's get to the episode.
This episode, we're talking with Professor Kevin Schaefer about his groundbreaking research on the power of fatherhood. This is Remaking Manhood, the Healthy Masculinity Podcast. I'm Mark Green.
And I'm Charles Matthews.
For generations, our culture has taught us a narrow and limiting set of rules for how to be a man. The end result? Epidemic levels of isolation and violence for boys and men, and for the multitude of others whose lives we impact.
But we can make a different choice. We can choose a masculinity of connection, and in return, have healthier relationships, more meaningful lives, and maybe even live longer. Every episode, you'll hear honest conversations designed to show you what breaking out of the man box can look like and feel like. Welcome to Remaking Manhood. We're glad you're here.
And now, our conversation with Dr. Kevin Schaefer. Kevin, thank you for joining us today on the Remaking Manhood Healthy Masculinity podcast. I really appreciate you coming. For those who might wonder how these conversations sort of get decided on or get created in the world, I saw a tweet from Kevin about his research on the impact of engaged fatherhood. And it struck me as a conversation that would both be educational for everybody out there, not only in terms of the results of the research, but also, you know, sort of how research itself happens. And in light of that, I'd like to just begin by welcoming you, Kevin, and thank you for being on the show. And if you want to just briefly let us know what your official title is at Brigham Young, and talk a little bit about how you arrived at the decision to do this particular research.
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of sociology at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. And how did I get to this research area? That is the $64,000 question in some ways, but part of it's because of my own sort of journey into becoming a father. So I have four children between the ages of 12 and 6. So I became really interested in how fatherhood shapes children's experiences, what predicts dads becoming involved with their children. And how does culture, how does our society value fatherhood? And how does that play out in the lives of children? So that really was the impetus, and realizing that there wasn't a lot of work on that particular topic. There was a lot of work on how do dads affect children, which I sort of refer to as B to C, but not a lot about A to B. In other words, what are the things that predict dads actually being involved and engaged with their children?
Fascinating. You know, I began as a writer 15 years ago now when my son was born. And I, too, had some simple questions like what does it mean to be an engaged father and how is that perceived at the park at noon on Tuesday? Like, who's that man sitting on the bench over there? And why is he in this park? There's children running around. Does he have one of them? Did he lose his job? What happened to that guy? And as time passed, I became more interested in the larger cultural messages around masculinity and how they would impact my son as he grew up. So it sounds like we have a similar path to taking an interest in these matters. But since you have four kids and I have one, and I think of myself as vastly challenged and overworked by the hugeness of parenthood, I can only imagine the degree to which you are doing that times four. So when you said I have four kids, Charles and I both went, man, that's intense. You know, like we were like, wow, kudos to you.
Yeah. So for someone who doesn't have kids and hasn't studied this, I'm just kind of curious, Kevin, about that, as you say, the B to C part, because the understanding of what fatherhood means to the kids, what fathers mean to kids, has changed a lot, even just in my lifetime. And I'm kind of curious if you can just briefly kind of run through like how those changes have happened and kind of where we are now in our understanding of, you know, are dads important? I mean, and there's even debate now about whether or not dads are important. I mean, some same-sex couples with two females are saying, why are we elevating this conversation around fatherhood and blah, 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 blah? Why is this big deal about men?
So the first thing I would say is that really it's about two parents. But for the vast, vast majority of families, that's going to consist of a mother and a father, right? Like that's the numeric norm, so to speak. So, but why fathers? So, you know, you correctly point out that there has been a massive shift in how we think about fatherhood in a very, very short amount of time. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that families have found themselves economically squeezed in substantial ways. And that coupled with, you know, third wave feminist movements that brought women into the workplace and brought women into educational institutions sort of really reshaped how we do family in the United States and throughout the Western world. And that change precipitated massive changes in family life as well. Because what was realized sort of very early on in early feminist writings when that was happening was what was referred to as the second shift, right? So moms would work their 8-hour work day, and then they would come home and be expected to do everything that was sort of normative at the time to take care of a family. And quickly, what was realized by many, many families is this is just completely not possible, right? We're burning out moms by doing that. And I think it altered how moms and dads thought about what their roles were in households. And I think that has led us to this shift. I think part of that shift is also what fathers figured out is that parenting is actually a really rewarding thing and that we can be good at it, right? And a message that wasn't received even as late as the 60s and 70s, that shift started to happen. Now, what we have right now is two sets of conflicting expectations, or two sets of expectations that often conflict with one another, to be more accurate. So on the one hand, we sort of have those historical expectations of breadwinning and being the disciplinarian, right? So as Mark pointed out, why is this man at this park at, you know, in the middle of the afternoon on a work day? That still happens, right? We know that stay-at-home dads, for example, still experience that. But at the same time, there's also an expectation that dads be involved and engaged in all aspects of raising a child. And that has led to some significant gains in improving what dads are doing at home. And, you know, to be quite honest, some significant challenges as well. There are some challenges that come with trying to do both work and family, really, particularly in a country that has virtually no supports for those things.
I would suggest also that that when fathers begin to engage in significant ways in parenting, especially over time, if that's a consistent, ongoing engagement for them, that it's actually transformational in terms of their emotional development. Because the way that I frame that is that it is probably one of the first times that they have been in service to another person, unless they might have been through an end-of-life experience with someone, a parent or something to that effect, and they've been there to serve in that way. But otherwise, you know, if you're regularly caring for an infant or a toddler, you don't get to say, no, not right now. I have something else I'd rather be doing. And that's a real shift for men. And I think once you give yourself over to that level of service, you begin to discover things about you that you may not have ever experienced before.
Audience, you can't see this, but Kevin's head has been going up and down very dramatically through Mark's comments.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And the research supports that, right? We know that having children really reshapes the lives of men in really significant ways. And I think you're absolutely right about that's really the first time that men enact service for someone else. And in part, right, it's because, you know, to provide an example, my father was born in 1947. I was born in 1980. You know, my father was a good dad by the standards of 1980s and 1990s fathering. You know, came to everything and was engaged and did those things. Was he a role model for caregiving? Was he a role model for emotional support? Not really. I mean, he was born in 1947, right? His father was born in 1917. So it just wasn't a model that existed, right? And I think what we're seeing now is we're starting to see the first generation of people of men who had a father that was highly involved and engaged in their lives, right?
Wow.
With sort of late millennials and Gen Zers, we're starting to see these are men and boys who were raised by men who took on caregiving tasks and who provided emotional support and saw parenting in this broad way, not just sort of this limited breadwinning and being a disciplinarian. So that generational change is taking a long time, right? When you sort of think about how time flows, you're like, oh yeah, I guess that sort of makes sense that we're finally starting to see the first fruits of that.
I wonder, in terms of your narrative, Kevin, to what degree has engaged parenting been a sort of a push me, pull you with your work as an academic?
Wow, that's a very good question. wow. So I think in a couple of ways. So I think it's the one thing that actually has led me to be really interested in the question of how masculinity shapes fathering and how fathering shapes masculinity. Because from the start, I decided along with my partner that I was not interested in parenting like I was parented. And that's to take nothing away from what my parents did, right? Like we're products of our times in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't interested in parenting how my wife was parented. And so, and you know, my dad, very blue collar guy, very macho. He was a firefighter for 30 years. And so that is not me, right? Like I'm an academic. I was always interested in school, always interested in sort of those sorts of things and always sort of move more towards like the history, English sorts of things. And so that was kind of gender atypical in a lot of ways. And so I was intrigued by that. You know, like I was intrigued by how something that I felt like I never really fit in with. How does that influence my parenting? How does that influence how I approach my children?
Can I ask one more really annoying question? To what do you attribute your ability to successfully differentiate from such a powerful symbol as your father seems to have represented for you?
Yeah. You can't come up with a more blue collar sort of stereotypically male job, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I think I attribute it to the fact that a couple of things. So one is my father always instilled in me the don't be a manual laborer. It's a really rough life, and it's a really challenging life, and it breaks down your body, and it makes you unhealthy, and it makes it so that you are so tired that you can't engage with your family, right? And it sort of limits what you can do in life. So don't do that if you can avoid it at all. That's not to take anything away from manual laborers, but you know, that was his philosophy.
So I'm going to say that's not an anti-intellectualism frame.
No, absolutely not.
No, I can see that that generation would have been like, yes, please be an intellectual, get paid mm-hmm. to use your brain. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think they saw the writing on the wall in terms of what the world was going to look like. And I grew up in the Rust Belt, which I think sort of influenced that as well, because we had a front row seat for seeing what the economy was going to do and what changes were going to happen.
So back to the collision between your academic career and your very real joy in parenting, mm-hmm. You've got the balance right? You feel okay about it?
No. So
I feel it too sometimes.
It's funny because I have students who ask me, you study fathering, you study fatherhood, that must make you like a really good dad. And the answer is, I don't think it makes me any better of a dad. I think it makes me feel more guilty about how I father. So I don't feel like I have it the right answer. I don't feel like I have the work family balance down the way that maybe it should be. I probably work too much and too frequently and don't spend enough time at home. But you know, I'm just as susceptible to sort of the social forces that shape how we do things as anybody else, right? Like I'm aware of them. I still do them. So wow. Yeah, like I think I could do better, you know? Yeah. And it's a conversation my partner and I have constantly about how I need to do better. And usually it's, you know, me saying I need to do better. But, and I think every colleague that I have here would say that they do the exact same thing and fall into the exact same traps.
May I ask you a research question?
Of course.
Tell me what research is. And specifically, as I understand it, the research you've been doing is past the ethical board and is peer reviewed. Is that the right term? Can you talk a little bit about what that is and what that means in terms of once you start telling us about your research? I mean, obviously that it in some way validates the research or.
Sure. So as a sociologist, I do research in a certain way. There are sociologists that do different kinds of research methodologies, but I am what's called a quantitative researcher. So I use survey data and statistical analyses to find average trends that exist within the population using samples that are meant to be representative of the population at large. So those samples look like, in this case, the United States. Right. So they're racially diverse in the way that the United States is racially diverse. They're educationally diverse in the way that the United States is. So they mirror the demographics of the country at large and of fathers in the US. So I use those statistical analyses to say something about trends in father involvement. Now, there are other researchers who do what's called qualitative research, which illuminates sort of what we do as quantitative researchers. So we say, oh, these are the trends, the broad trends that exist within society. Qualitative researchers will do those one-on-one interviews with dads to sort of figure out really what is happening in their psyches. What kinds of challenges do they experience? How do they put it in their own words? And together, quantitative and qualitative researchers help shape a story about what is happening in the lives of individuals and how what we call social institutions, things like public policy, things like schools, things like religious institutions, et cetera, how those things shape how men act and react, in this case, as parents.
That's great. So you might be, you or a quantitative researcher might be tracking that men are having kids later. Mm-hmm. And a qualitative researcher might be figuring out why some men are having kids later.
That's exactly
how
right.
They experience that. How they experience
Yeah, right.
That.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, I didn't have my son until I was 45. having kids later, having less kids, having kids when you're young, older, whatever, your research on fatherhood would span all those different versions of being a father, right? So tell me, tell us what some of the results are that have been coming out of this. You the question you pose is phrased how in terms of some of that research?
Right. So what I generally do, particularly as it relates to masculinity, is use scales that have been created and validated by psychologists about what is traditional, what we would call traditional masculinity, and even, you know, into what we might term toxic masculinity, right? So these are things like avoidance of the feminine, being a workaholic, being emotionally stoic, right? Sort of what we might popularly call being a man's man, to put air quotes around it. The man box is another way to sort of think about it, right?
Right. And you just lost half the audience right there, because as soon as you said toxic masculinity, they all yanked the ripcord and said, well, this is a biased conversation. It's
right.
It's not legit. It's not accurate. I'm out. And and so there's a lot of reactivity around those frames, right? But we know that, you know, being a workaholic isn't healthy. We know that being emotionally stoic isn't very good for forming connection or relationships or community. Right. So we're just going to have to live with that. With that. When we call it toxic in this case, we're talking about having an actual health impact as well.
That's right. Like, so when we say toxic, we don't mean it as masculinity is toxic, right? That's not what that terminology means. What that terminology means is masculinity that turns toxic towards men, right? Like, there are reasons why men die earlier than women, and it's not biological and it's not physiological. The difference is men literally kill themselves through being workaholics, through risky behaviors, and through not engaging in healthy behaviors. Like, that's literally what it is, right?
And the social isolation has huge health impacts. I mean, damage
precisely
is equivalent to smoking. So when you framed your question for your study, you were saying, how is this behavior passed on generation to generation?
Right. Yeah. So how does the kind of dad that you have or had as a child, how does that influence how you see and experience the world as a male, right? Might be the best way to describe it. And how does that, what are your attitudes about masculinity, right? These sort of traditional masculine norms. Do you avoid the feminine or take on a caring masculinity, right? Is providing care for other people central to who you are?
And is it gendered as feminine in our culture?
Mm-hmm.
Is it even actually a feminine behavior to care for other people or you know?
Right. Yeah. I think we would say it's feminine coded, right? Because
sure. Well, yeah, it's viewed as feminine. There's no doubt
right.
about that, especially in the dominant culture. Wow. That's like a lot of stuff that we all sort of know is happening. But at the same time, it creates a lot of anger and reactivity when you start to try to name it and address it and talk about
right.
it. So you
Certainly.
Did research around it. And what did you learn?
So what I learned is that the more involved your own father was, the more you reject these masculine norms. So the less you see success at work and financially as the end all be all of human existence, the less likely you are to hold what we call traditional gender attitudes, right? So you sort of see equal partnership in relationships and in parenting as important. You believe that men and women have equal value in political spheres and at work. A rejection of what I would call like heterosexual conquest, right? The idea that the number of sexual partners I have says something about me as a man. And they're less emotionally stoic. So they're less socially isolated. They're more likely to talk about their emotions. They're more likely to provide emotional support to other people.
And this all came from just the dad being more engaged. Was that the, was that the defining characteristic? So the dad could be kind of a man's man, could be mm-hmm. kind of a hyper masculine guy, but so long as he was engaged.
Yeah. So it's like, how involved was your father in your life? Was he emotionally close to you? Did you get along? Did he come to your events? Did you talk about important things in your life? Sort of these sort of standard fathering behaviors, right? The more dads did those sorts of things, the less masculine, quote unquote, traditionally masculine these men said that they were, right? They were okay. More nurturing, more engaged at home.
So they were engaged fathers. They were engaged fathers within the constraints of whatever was typical for that historic period. Mm-hmm. So a father in the 80s or a father in the 60s or whatever it was. And do you think that one of the byproducts of having an engaged father was the confidence you need to go ahead and be more expansive in your expression and participation in the world? Does it increase confidence in boys?
Yeah, I think it's exact. I mean, I think that's exactly right. Right. I think we behave in ways that we experience ourselves. Right. And so the best person that we have to understand how to be a parent are our own parents. Many of us parent in ways that look a lot like how our parents parented. And so I think it does give them that confidence. I think it says that this is something that was important in my family, and that being a caring, loving individual who puts family above work and who sees the value of a diverse society matters, right? My dad showed me that through his own behavior. And now I'm replicating it in my behavior as well, under, of course, a new set of right. social norms
in the way that is normative for this population.
Precisely.
At this time.
Precisely.
What percentage of your respondents indicated that they had an engaged father?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of them sort of say their dad was somewhere in the middle range. So not highly engaged, but not, completely ignoring their existence, I guess.
Right. Indifferent.
Yeah. So I think you get maybe like 15 to 20% of those men had really engaged fathers. I think that number is significantly higher today than it was, 30 years ago. Wow. So.
And could an engaged stepfather fill in and make a difference? Okay. So the biological relationship didn't matter.
Yeah. That's the coolest part about this questionnaire is it literally could be whomever you considered your father figure. So it could be your biological father. It could be your stepfather. It could be a grandfather who helped raise you. It could be a mentor, right? So it's a really, really broad spectrum of dads. In fact, in this data, only about 7 in 10 men call their biological father their father, right? So you have 30% of people who are saying my father figure was somebody that wasn't my biological father. And yet that effect is the same no matter what.
Would that have to be someone who was in relationship with them for at least a couple of years, or like how long do they before to have an impact like that?
Yeah, we let them define who their father figure was, and we didn't put time limits on it. So it could have, and
somebody
very, very few
impact.
Men.
Somebody had a big
somebody,
impact.
Right. Very, very few men indicated that they did not have someone in their life that was a father figure. And interestingly, a not an insignificant proportion actually said that their mother was their father figure in this data. And we allow for that as well. So, yeah.
So a strong mother, I've heard many men say that their progressive ideas about manhood came from their relationship with their mother, not just their mother told them to do it, but that it was born out of witnessing her life and being engaged with her.
I think that's very, very common.
So you found out that 10 to 15% of people from that previous era, someone whose father probably that was parenting them at least by the early 90s, I would guess, that 10 to 15% of those men said they had that level of engagement from their father figure or father?
That's correct.
That seems like that's pretty sparse. I mean,
yeah.
But is there any way to begin to determine how many fathers, how many men are now engaged? Because I also think some men are making that choice in spite of an absent or a disengaged father figure. I don't know.
That is absolutely accurate. Yeah. So, you know, like I said earlier, we learn how to parent from our own parents. And what many, many men say is that they want to be better than their own father was, right? Mm-hmm. So for some men, they never knew who their father was. So they might define that as, I'm going to be there for my child. Because mm-hmm. to them, that's 100% more than they got from their own father. For some of us, like myself, you know, I would say, hey, my dad was pretty good, but never really involved in the caregiving piece, never really involved in the sort of the domestic labor part of being a parent. I'm committed to being more than that. So lots and lots of men look at their father, appreciate everything that their father did for them, understand that fathering looked way different historically than it does now, but say, you know, I want to be more than just that. Because I think for many men, they experience the pain of not having had a father that was really involved and engaged. And they take that personally in a lot of ways. And they don't want their own child to say the same thing about them.
Can you talk about some specific results from the study? I feel like we're sort of speaking in general ways. Right. And I'd just be curious about, was there anything that surprised you in terms of the data really showing spikes in some places?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I was most surprised by just how broad the effects of your own father being really involved in your life were for men. I thought, oh, there's going to be some impact there. It's obviously going to influence how they parent themselves. But beyond that, I'm not sure how big these effects really are going to be. And yet they tend to be really big effects, and they tend to be really, really broad. And I know, you know, we're speaking in generalities. It's one of the problems with the kind of statistical analysis that gets done. But, you know, for example, one of the things that we found in this analysis is that there's a strong rejection of sexist attitudes about women if one's father was involved and engaged. Now, why might that be? I think the answer in this case is they are less likely to think of caregiving exclusively as women's work, and they're more likely to see that as gender neutral kinds of work. And they're more likely to see paid work similarly as gender neutral, because that's what they experienced in their own lives.
So let's just hang on for that for a second, because this is really important, that the idea that a positive relationship between, you know, just to put it really generically, between an older man and a younger mm-hmm. man changes how that younger man relates to women.
Right.
That's a remarkable jump.
Yeah. So one of the arguments that we in academia have made for many, many years is the key to gender equality in any culture, in any society, is equality at home. Equality at work, equality in politics, equality wherever, it starts at home. Now, there's reasons why that equality doesn't exist, and it's beyond just cultural norms. But, you know, our workplaces aren't super family friendly, for example. And our workplaces have expectations, and those expectations are gendered. That nobody polices gender better than the workplace does. But we've maintained that involved fatherhood would lead to greater gender equality. And I think what our results show is that's true. So if somebody went from, not to get super in the weeds on statistics, but...
Oh, do. Let's do that.
Okay. So generally speaking, we think that what we call a standard deviation change. So, right, whatever the mean difference within the population is. If that number gets above 0.25, that's a pretty big effect. It's meaningful. In the data that we have, that effect is about 0.25. So if we go up on this, you know, your dad was nurturing scale, one standard deviation, we get a decrease in traditional attitudes of a quarter standard deviation, which is a relatively sizable effect in the social sciences. So what we're finding is, you know, the more nurturing your father was, the less traditional gender attitudes you maintain. To that sort of gives us some evidence and some clue that what we have long hypothesized is true about the relationship between having an involved father and gender equality exists, right? And it doesn't just exist in one generation, but it exists in multiple generations, right? That's passed down from generation to generation. I think that's a really compelling and interesting outcome that we have seen in other places, right? So, you know, sort of the gold standard for this is Scandinavian countries. We've seen that outcome there as well. And this shows some evidence that it's true here. Now, if that were to hold, as dads get more and more involved and more engaged over time, those attitudes are going to become increasingly normative. In part, not wholly, but in part because of the involvement and engagement that is happening in the home with children, providing care, providing service, as Mark put it earlier, that has value, right? It changes the way that we think about ourselves, and it changes the way that we think about women.
That's fascinating. That's really, and I might interview Mark here a little bit on this, because it's, you know, thinking about how we apply the concept of the man box and this concept of the domination culture that drives men to subjugate, harm, ignore, put down women, you know, comes from this idea of just ongoing competition, that there's always this scrabbling for dominance. That's what we get trained to do. Rather than to connect, we get trained to dominate. So I'm curious, like, what is it about, and I'm curious, but I can also feel this in my body when I think about my relationships with my dad, like, what is it about having an engaged, loving father that disentangles at least a little bit, a quarter of a standard deviation, that disentangles a young person from dominance and that dominance hierarchy?
The work that Niobe Way does and other people do shows how the system of masculinity, you know, intentionally disengages boys from emotional expression, from showing their emotional acuity, from expressing all of these things. And one might arrive at the conclusion that if a father is engaged in the home, especially around expression, connection, affection, that his influence is going to counter some of that disengagement, that sort of cultural pressure for boys to be emotionally stoic, tough, dominant, always certain, always correct, always controlling women and girls, all of those performances of domination, because boys do that in the absence of authentic connection with girls and women. Boys and men do that, but also they know that they'll be policed for performing kindness or equity with girls. That shows up in Judy Chu's book, Don't Tell the Head of the Boys Club I'm Friends with the Girls or He'll Kick Me Out of the Club and I Won't Have a Club. So one of the little four-year-old boys tells her in that book, in part of her research. But ultimately, if you have a father figure at home who says, I love you, I care about you, I respect you for who you are, that can countermand some of that cultural stuff. So my guess is, based on what you're telling us, Kevin, is that the dads have, like, you know, extra super hit points on impact compared to culture.
Yes. I mean, I think that's totally right. Right. And I think, look, that's how we all sort of experience life in a lot of ways, right? Like, our own personal experiences will always trump the sort of the broader experiences, narrative, right? Yeah. And we see that frequently in things like politics and everyone else and other, you know, realms of life. The more sort of personal you get, the more that you show someone that this has a personal impact on them, or the more that you connect with their past, the more likely they are going to be on board with something, right? We are learners by experience as human beings, typically. And so I think that's exactly right. If I see my dad doing this thing, particularly as we have talked about, in a culture that doesn't value these things when they were being raised, that's going to have a massive, massive impact on how these men see themselves, how they act and interact with other people, and how they act and interact as fathers themselves.
Yeah, that's a lived experience. So it trumps bullying or whatever.
Right.
Wanted to get to a question, Kevin, about masculinity extremism or white and male supremacy, and whether or not your work, either currently or in the future, would seek to address any of that in relationship to engaged fatherhood, engaged parenting.
Yeah, that is a great question. Thank you for asking it. It's a question that's of significant importance in our day and age. I don't think anybody can, you know, to be quite frank, I don't think anybody could have looked at what happened on January 6th and not seen that as an expression of extreme masculinity. That's all I saw when I saw it, was that kind of extremism and masculinity sort of coming together in that particular way. So we are undertaking that research right now. Myself and a student here at BYU are thinking about that in all kinds of ways. The survey that we've been referring to throughout this discussion actually allows us to also look at what is the relationship between how masculine a father identifies and how much he teaches his children about cultural values, what we call cultural values, but valuing a multicultural, multi-ethnic society, essentially. So how much do you engage in teaching your children about other cultures? How much do you engage in teaching about, you know, right and wrong? How much do you engage in bringing in, you know, books and films and other things by people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds than your own? And the answer is masculinity matters here too, right? And this is in relation, these are dads in their own words, essentially, who the higher that masculinity scale goes, the less likely they are to engage in teaching their children about other cultures and teaching their children about racial equality and in valuing a broad multicultural experience. Now, that's only one way to look at it.
You're talking about that traditional masculinity scale, right?
Right. Correct. Say, yeah. Okay. Correct. So that same scale that we've been referring to.
These words are so loaded. They really are.
Like, they are. Yeah.
Like somehow we're just going to tell the world that traditions are a bad thing, or
right,
that traditional is bad, when in fact people are very, they have a lot of ownership around the word masculinity and around
right,
traditional. And
right,
I
think it's,
I struggle with it, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important to note that as we talk about this, this is not intended to be an attack on masculinity. There are many, many positive things about masculinity.
About traditional masculinity.
Right, about traditional masculinity, right? Certainly, there are many positive things about it. You know, one example is that more masculine men are better at things like smoking cessation than less masculine men, right? So there are these examples out there that traditional masculinity is not bad. I consider myself, you know, a relatively masculine person, but we're talking about extremes. So maybe the best way to talk about it is extreme masculinity. Unfortunately, academics are not particularly good at inventing terms that aren't completely loaded when they get into the public sphere. So
yeah. Well, and when you talk about extreme masculinity, or as we've like to refer to it, traditional masculinity, you're saying that 85% of your survey respondents had that version of a father, or on some scale of that, like they felt like that. My dad fell into the
they felt in either into the meaty part of that distribution, or their father was like highly engaged, right? And there's many reasons why dads aren't highly engaged fathers. Masculinity is one of them, but that's not the end all be all.
Trauma, you know.
Certainly, yeah.
So many men in my father's generation came out of the Second World War, and we didn't even have the phrase PTSD. We didn't have any language for it. And those men were absolutely put through the ringer in terms of their experiences. They had no way to process emotionally, none of that stuff. And I would suspect that a lot of Vietnam veterans went through a similar impact, right? And there was no process for that. And veterans now coming back from Afghanistan are no different. But at least now we have language around it and ways to try and treat it, and we can acknowledge it. But our you know, generations of fathers were attempting to manage huge expectations around this keeping up with the Joneses. You know, if their identity was wage earner, they were in a pretty significant arc from the 50s and 60s when the, you know, the streets were paved with gold through to the economic collapses that came thereafter. And as you pointed out, Kevin, these economic collapses led to many of the men who are now full-time caregivers while their wives pursue careers that may be more lucrative. So the changes that traditional masculinity has had to confront have in many ways, and if we talk about traditional masculinity having value too, what we're really talking about is a broader range of masculinity, which allows both traditional masculine skills. I'm going to get the ladder and go up on the roof and fix that, you know, reshingle that thing because I'm not paying a roofing guy. And to be able to express emotionally with our kids and to be there supportively for our spouses and to take pleasure in the small nuanced moments of connection in family life, right?
That is exactly right. Yes. Yes.
Yay.
Beautifully said.
I got it right.
So in fact, in academia, we have an academic term for what you just referred to, which is caring masculinities, right? Which is the integration of wanting to care for your children and to be a loving, supportive partner to whomever you're partnered with. That is caring masculinities, right? And that is adding it to sort of other elements of masculinity in ways that are really beneficial.
Right. We're not subtractive about masculinity. We're not saying take parts out. We're saying add parts in.
Exactly right. Yeah. So really good example of these, of this kind of thing is what we see in religious men. Like religious men sort of engage in parenting in this way and in life this way, because to them, they sanctify family relationships. Those are important religious elements to them, right? And to their being. And because they sanctify those relationships, they are highly engaged with their children and highly engaged with their partners as a result. So to me, that is like what we're really speaking about, is a caring masculinity is a great framework for thinking about positive influences on kids, positive influences on partners, positive influences on yourself as a man. And, you know, sort of harkening back to our discussion of toxic and what do we mean by toxic and for whom and for your communities, right? So that is really the ideal type that we, you know, really are striving for, a healthy version of masculinity.
So in 20 years, you'll be able to tell us what percentage of men now will say that they had an engaged father, and we'll see that number going up, hopefully.
Absolutely. Though I will say that fathers are more involved and more engaged today than they ever have been historically. So we are really in a day and age where dads are doing more and really are doing their best. I think that there are lots
off of that.
I think so. I think there are a lot of structural barriers that exist that prevent dads from being as involved and engaged as they would like to be. And I think that is really what's important. I do not ever want to be someone that says, oh, dads aren't doing enough. Dads are bad. Men are bad. That is not, hopefully, the message that's coming across. What I am saying is that we live in a society that makes life very, very challenging for men. Yeah. And that we can create a society and create a culture that values care work among men and that values other things that men are involved in engaged.
Right. And that pays men enough that they don't have to work three jobs
exactly,
to take care
exactly,
of
yes.
to afford their home and their children's food. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we have more than a third of men in the United States who work more than 50 hours a week. Mm. That's an incredible amount of work. That comparable figure, by the way, among our neighbors to the north is 5%. So Wow. That's the difference we're talking about, right?
Right. Not a working, they can't get a decent working wage, so they have to work multiple jobs or long hours or whatever that might be. We're not talking about law office partners here. We're talking about working men.
Exactly.
So anything, Charles, that you want to...
I just want to thank Kevin for this conversation. It's been, you know, really hopeful as usual. This is, you know, this has been marks in my experience that when we talk to guys who are really on the forefront of figuring out where men are at, we get to feel a lot more hopeful. You know, Mark and I are both a little bit older than you are. We come from a generation where things maybe weren't so hopeful. So it's great to hear about what you're finding in the data, and also great to hear that you are so committed to creating the kind of family that is good for kids and good for the future generations. Thanks for being a part of that.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And in terms of hopefulness, I just know, you know, I get the advantage of talking to students all the time. So I get the advantage of talking to people in their early 20s quite a bit. And man, they make me hopeful, really. Like just hearing their commitment to what they want to do when they have children themselves, how much they value the idea of being a dad, and how much they see that as part of being male, that really gives me a lot of hope and strengthens my sort of resolve to keep working on this in this area.
Kevin, are there some resources for dads out there, either in your work or other people's work?
Yeah, so you can, I feel like a politician, like plugging like donations here, but you can go to my website, which is kevinshafer.org. And there are links there. You can also go to my research page and you can sort of find the research papers there as well. And there are many, many great resources available out there. I would suggest any number of fatherhood websites and organizations. Urban Dads is a great one. Fatherhood Research and Practice Network is a great one. Even fatherhood.gov is a great resource that you can go to that's maintained by the Department of Health and Human Services, where they put a lot of resources there that are based in evidence-based practice. And many, many, many places throughout this country have fatherhood classes that you can attend where they talk about this thing. I know that exists here in Utah. I work with an organization that does it in California and many, many other places throughout the country. And the fun part about that is they will pay you and feed you to take that class. So most people, we have to pay to take classes. Dads apparently get paid to take those classes, but all of those things exist. And I highly recommend them.
Yeah. I also want to just give a shout out to City Dads Group, which is just one example. City Dads Group, there's like the Dallas Dads Group, the Houston Dads Group. They're all part of City Dads Group. If you go to City Dads Group National, you can find a group of dads in your local area in most major cities where you can hook up with those guys and go out to events and your kids can meet each other and you can talk about the trials and tribulations of you know, figuring out how to use a sippy cup and whatever else you might be up against as a father. And they create wonderful community. They have bowling nights. They do what they need to do to support each other and to support the women who might be working or dads who might be divorced or whatever that is. So
City Dads is a great organization. Yes, exactly. And I will say that in relation to those services, if you go to fatherhood.gov, you can actually find a program map and look for services near you that provide fatherhood programs.
Yeah. I think the one thing that we ran into a lot of was that fully engaged dads get isolated just like full primary caregiver moms do. And one of the things that really was helpful was what they could get together with other stay-at-home dads, primary caregiving dads, and sort of break out of that isolation. And finally just take over the park and be like, what's that mom doing here? So it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
I love it. I love it.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it and appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
All right, Kevin, you're free to go see your wonderful family.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
So what do you think of all that, Charles?
It's just feeling hopeful, feeling amazed. And I think it takes pressure off of women and moms, which I really like. You know, for a while there in the late 90s, early aughts, there were these books directed at women about how to raise a son. And there was this kind of onus placed on women to raise a boy.
Right, like they were supposed to fix everything else. You also need to fix that.
right. So that you could raise a son who's not going to be an oppressive, you know, rapey jerk, right? And the idea that it's just like, just make sure that there's a healthy relationship between a kid and his dad, whatever his dad is, whatever father figure is there. And I think he didn't quite get to put a wrapper on it, but the data that they're finding about how healthy relationships with engaged fathers actually sounds like decreases white supremacist ideas, racist ideas, sexist ideas. Wow, that seems like a silver bullet, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that's research that's ongoing now. And the other thing is that we really, as men, we need to let go of this idea that you can't touch masculinity. Don't talk about masculinity. Don't frame masculinity as having versions of it that are negative. We got to get in and pop the hood on it and start checking out what's going on with, I mean, we got big problems in terms of how masculinity is being performed in the world. And it's crucial that we begin to get comfortable with the idea that if somebody wants to say a version of masculinity that might be more traditional, but in a negative way is kind of toxic for men, we can't just throw our hands up and leave the room, right? That's not going to help anybody. If you want to make the case for traditional masculine values, go right ahead. But if those values include, you know, emotional stoicism and control over women and girls and whatever, you're going to get pushback on that. But the rest of us are all part of that culture of masculinity, and we carry pieces of that narrative in us. And for those of us who maybe thought, this is such a delicate machine, this father and son dynamic, how do I make sure I do this right? Well, it turns out you just love them.
Yeah.
And maybe love your partner a little too. Just be kind and be there and be supportive and do your fair share.
Yeah.
And this powerful impact comes out of it.
Yeah.
Which his data is apparently showing a significant shift. Our job's easy. Just be decent, loving, engaged human beings, God forbid.
Yep.
And we're home free with our kids.
And I talked about how I could feel that in my body. I didn't really get to explain it while Kevin was on the line. But, you know, I only had my dad until I was 10 because he died of cancer. But I remember what it felt like for him to tell me that he loved me. And to hold me.
Yeah.
And that, like, even now, 45 years later, that still feels like a protective factor. You know, that still feels like medicine.
I have the same story about my dad. My parents got divorced and he left for a while when I was 7. But I still remember how some nights at 10 o'clock at night, my mom had gone to bed, my brothers and I had all gone to bed, my sisters were asleep. And I would hear little, you know, 4-year-old me like, all ears, would hear the blender start up in the kitchen. Back then they Osterizer blender, and we ate what was called Melarine, which was a version of, you know, vanilla ice cream made from cottonseed oil or something. I have no idea. That would have been in the very early 60s. And I would get up and tiptoe to the door to wake my brother up. He's sleeping in the bed next to me. And I open that door and I just peek down this ranch style house hallway. And down at the end, he'd be sitting on the couch with a lamp lit behind him, and he would hold up a milkshake for me. He'd have two of them. And I would sneak down that hallway and tuck in under his arm, and the Late Show would be beginning on TV, you know, and they had a song in the 1950s that went with that Late Show. The Late Show, nothing could be finer than the Late Show. Nothing could be finer than the greatest of stars right on your own TV. And I remember that song better than I remember 90% of my damn life, because I was tucked under his arm and he gave me that milkshake. And we would watch a little, you know, cowboys and Indians or gangsters firing machine guns. I didn't care. Drink that milkshake and I go back to bed. And I felt, long after he was gone, and he was gone for a number of years, he took a job overseas after the divorce, I still remember what it feels like to be loved here now, 61 years old. He taught me that in those moments. So you're spot on, man. The protective piece that created for me was, I am worthy of love in spite of all the other messages I got, maybe that didn't convince me of that over the following years.
Yeah. Oh, I hope there's some dads out there now listening to it and feeling motivated.
Just love them, man. Just hold them close and love them, and you will make a, you will give them indelible messages about their own value, your children.
And that gives you value, right? As a parent, now you have some value.
As we are shaping them, they are shaping us. That's parenting. Charles, thank you for all the work you've done with kids and all the work you're doing in the world. I love you for the way that you frame things and the way that you talk and think. So until we meet again on this podcast, sir.
This has been Remaking Manhood, the Healthy Masculinity Podcast.
You can connect with me and find more of my writing and speaking on the website charlesmatthews.com. That's C-H-A-R-L-E-S mathesus.com. You can also interact with me and with other men who are working to craft authentic, workable masculinities in the group Redefining Strength on Facebook.
You can find me, Mark Green, on most social media platforms at Remaking Manhood, and you can find me at remakingmanhood.com.
Thank you so much for listening to this reissue of the Remaking Manhood podcast episode with Kevin Schaefer. You know, all episodes of the Remaking Manhood podcast include this kind of intimate, surprising, and exciting conversation with young men, older men, women, men of various races and backgrounds. What they all have in common is a story about how we can escape the man box and find more freedom, connection, and compassion. We hope you'll listen to more episodes of the Remaking Manhood podcast, and we hope you'll tell others about it, especially men. Use these episodes to support and start one of the most critical conversations we can have today. How can we remake manhood into something healthy and sustainable? And while I have you here, I just want to thank everyone who participated in the Men Talk Feminism Challenge, sponsored by Maria Orihuela, our guest from episode 82. A couple of you listeners contributed to the online entries and helped inch the conversation along. Thank you for breaking down the stigma. And just a reminder, there's lots of resources in the show notes for this episode. Links to Kevin's research, links to many of the parenting and fathering groups that Mark and Kevin mentioned. We encourage you to educate yourself about men's work and connected fathering. And of course, I urge you to subscribe to the Remaking Manhood podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get a podcast. Follow Mark on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Remaking Manhood, and join me in the Redefining Strength Facebook group. This is Charles Matthews wishing you a band of merry men who lead you to authenticity and peace. We love you. The Here Together podcast is a project of Rocket Feather Creative.